It's a beautiful morning. I think I'll go outside for a while. Just smile. Just taking some clean, fresh air for me.
Stay inside.
If the weather's fine and you got the time, it's your chance to wake up and plan another brand new day.
Good morning, Barcelona. Welcome to Thursday. Yes, it is Thursday. English Radio and RKB 106.9 FM. I'm Virgil, still and always. For the past couple of weeks, I've talked about a lot of the latest trends in research around better treatments for advanced prostate cancer, developments for a potential cure, but really, where cure is necessary, is it possible? This kind of existential question and others will be answered today by our two guests, Dr. Begoña Mellado, MD and PhD, who's a medical oncologist and a investigator in translational research. And also Dr. Joaquin Mateo, also a medical oncologist at Vall d'Hebron. Welcome to the show, folks.
Hello.
Hello, Virgil. Thank you for having us.
Short and sweet. That's good. Well, next Friday, you both are going to be participating in a very significant event on the issue of clinical cancer research for prostate cancer. Tell me about it.
So that's actually going to be the second of our series of events. We are trying to meet with patients, but not necessarily only patients, but people from society in general that is interested into what are we doing to advance in prostate cancer. So this is a half a day meeting that we're going to be hosting at the Hotel 1882 in Barcelona near Sagrada Familia, and everyone is welcome to come, and there will be a series of talks from different investigators involving prostate cancer. And it's basically an open, very informal session when everyone can come, have a coffee, ask questions if they are interested in what's going on in the prostate cancer field.
And it's not just for patients, it's for families and for friends and coworkers, anybody who is been touched by prostate cancer, either directly or indirectly.
Totally. And even outside prostate cancer, people who may have an interest in this topic or in the topic in cancer research in general is more than welcome.
Well, I think it's key because if we look at some of the things that have been happening that we've seen in prostate cancer research, for example, we know that there's a relationship between breast cancer and prostate cancer. So men who've had female relatives who had breast cancer are at a higher risk of getting prostate cancer. So it's a cancer for everybody who really has an interest in cancer to come and get informed. Now, one of the other things we think is key is that, you know, why is it really important for patients and their families to come to the conference?
Well, I think it is important because patients and families, doctors in the clinic, we don't have time to explain everything about prostate cancer. And there are a lot of news in the media, internet, sometimes people, patients and families look for results and news that they don't know how to interpret. And this is an opportunity for them to be in contact, direct contact with doctors and scientists that we are working in prostate cancer and receive direct information from them. That's, I think it's a very good opportunity.
I think it is because, as we've seen from our previous symposium, the people, not only just patients, but people, their family members, their wives, daughters, granddaughters, were asking a lot of questions that they didn't really have time to ask when they go to the hospital or in the doctor's office. You know, they feel pressured to get in and get out. But here they had a free-flowing discussion and really had a lot of fun with that.
And it's not only the time that sometimes in a medical consultation in the hospital you would not have the time to discuss things outside the particular case of the patient, but it's also that we want to take this discussion to a different atmosphere, the atmosphere of a cafe in a hotel where people may feel more comfortable to have these kind of conversations.
I think that's true, and that's been good, and we want to have folks come out. Again, that's next Friday at Hotel 1882 on Corsica. In Barcelona. You know, it starts around 9 o'clock. We're going to feed you a free breakfast and everything else and give you some great information. We'll be back to talk more with our guests right after this.
Thank you.
And it was Miles Sanko with This Ain't Living. Well, we're living here today. I mean, we're living it up. We're living in Barcelona. We're living the good life. But we're talking about the things that's going to help you keep yourself alive and living the life you want to live. You know, being able to talk about cancer, cancer research, cancer prevention. Now, this next week, the symposium, you know, sponsored by the Prostate Net and Bayer Healthcare, will focus on advanced stage prostate cancer. But I think it's really important to understand the path of prostate cancer from diagnosis to possibly death. Talk to us about that progression.
Okay. It is important, first of all, it is important to point out that most of patients with localized prostate cancer can be cured. But after that...
Well, you're talking to one. You know, here I am 24 years later, so I don't think it didn't get me then, so that's not going to get me now.
Okay, great. But some patients are not curable, and how they progress. We might have different kind of progressions, and usually the progression might be long, during years and years of duration. Sometimes we can see, very often, the first sign of progression we see is an elevation of the PSA in the blood. Mm-hmm. And this is telling us that probably there is activity of the tumor or somewhere, sometimes in the prostate, and if the patient has been not treated with surgery, or in another place. And very often we cannot see anything. We only see the PSA that is rising, after years, if we don't treat this PSA, the prostate cancer can go to the bones or the lymph nodes or other places.
Let me interrupt you for a minute. When you talk about the PSA, the prostate specific antigen test. Now, that isn't in itself an indication that you have prostate cancer. It just says there's something happening in the prostate.
Yes.
So it could be like as men get older, the prostate enlarges, and that will drive the prostate PSA level up. Also, certain kinds of exercise. If you ride a bicycle a lot, you can have an increased level of PSA. If you eat some spicy foods on a regular basis, your PSA can come up. So the key thing is that you need to watch your PSA, number one, to see is it moving, how fast it's moving, because then that's going to be an indication of doing something else at that point, which is like maybe have a biopsy.
Yeah, that's right, yeah.
Yeah, and I normally always tell my patients that actually when we look at PSA, we don't get too anxious about one abnormal value, but we look at trends over time. But I know when you come to the clinic, you have one abnormal value, you get very anxious. But you were saying there are many other reasons than prostate cancer that can get isolated spikes on the PSA. And it's important to always have the perspective of two or three values to interpret it correctly.
This is very important. I always say to my patients, you are not only the PSA, because they are very worried about the PSA, and it is important to look everything in context. No?
So after that point, we say, all right, they have a biopsy, and they get diagnosed, and the biopsy tells them that, okay, you do have prostate cancer. Then, obviously, most men, including myself, when you hear that word, you've got cancer, your mind totally goes on reject, and you don't hear anything else at that point. So then, after the biopsy, they have choices to make in terms of whether they want to do surgery or radiation or something else. Now, the thinking is that prostate cancer is a slow growing disease. So once you get that diagnosis, how quickly do you need to do something? Immediately, like my wife says, we got to get you into surgery next week. I said, no, we don't have to. So how slowly is it moving at that point? How slowly do the cells move?
It depends on the case. Every patient would be different. Clearly, this is not like, a lung puncture that you just have to go into the theater urgently before the patient collapses, right? You can. Actually, it's good that there is some time to study the disease well, do imaging tests to make sure where the disease has spread to, how big is the tumor. So it's not something you have to operate within a week, but of course not in a year time, but you need to take the time to study well the disease and plan the treatment. And sometimes even we consider that it's beneficial for some patients to have some treatment before this surgery with some androgen shots. So it will change from one case to another. And there is a subset of cases where we can detect very slow-growing diseases where we may actually not offer the patient, or we may offer the patient an alternative to have surgery that is just to watch and see, because he may not need surgery for several years.
True. So we talk about then treatment. So once you've made the point of saying, all right, you have time within, say, 3 months to make a decision, and you have either surgery or radiation. Again, I guess it depends upon the case, depending upon the stage of disease, whether, the aggressiveness of the tumor. That primary therapy may cure the disease, and they might be fine for the rest of their lives. But in some cases, we say, the trend is, 20 to 50, depending on who you ask and, what they believe, that it relapses. And then at that point, we start looking at, advanced stage disease, if we want to call it that. So in that period of advanced stage disease where we'll look to say, all right, then you need to do androgen deprivation therapy or you need to do something else, how much time then plays in there? How long does the androgen deprivation therapy work?
Well, again, it's very difficult to give a number for the overall population. When patients ask me if the disease has spread outside the prostate and you start androgen deprivation to actually treat these other lesions elsewhere in the body, you could say that the median, and that means that half of the people do better, half of the people do worse, could be between 1 or 2 years. But this is changing very rapidly because in the last few years, we have learned through clinical research that sometimes it's actually better to kick the disease as hard as we can from the very beginning and add some drugs that we were before keeping for later stages, right. keeping giving them up from with androgen deprivation, and that may increase the time from 1 to 2 to maybe 2 to 3 or even more.
Which is great. So then at that point, you know, we know that the androgen deprivation stops working and they become what we call castrate resistant. Then we start looking at things like chemotherapy and all the rest. In that point, you know, how long can we then prolong life?
Well,
I know it depends on the patient always, but
of course depends on the patient. But there are many different treatments available right now for castration-resistant prostate cancer, and it's clear that we can improve the survival of the patients more 2 or 3 more years. But it's something I don't like to say. These numbers, because right. everything is patient, is different, no? It depends on many things and how they respond. But
I think the whole thing that we have to really get across is that it's not, you know, you're not going to die immediately.
No.
You know, we've got things that work.
And I've been working in prostate cancer and seeing patients for many years, and I have experienced the improvement of the management of the disease year per year, and my patients, I know that my patients can live now and better now than 5 or 10 years before. So when I see a patient, I said, we have this now, but maybe in 3 years we are going to have something else, and that's that mm-hmm. because the research is moving very, very quickly. We are having new drugs and new strategies, mm-hmm. and I think that there is a big chance of improvement.
Huh? I think that point is very important, yeah. what Begoña said, because it's actually not only the option of getting a new drug, it's the fact that in 2 years' time, the scenario may be completely different, and there may be new knowledge that offers you new options that we don't
Absolutely.
Have now.
Absolutely. Because we look at just, you know, in the last 5 years, all the new drugs that have come out, it's been amazing. And then the fact of using the drugs in combination, that also is a relatively new thing, which I think is important. Now, talking about that, you know, when you talked about, you know, the failure, you know, that first course of treatment, the surgery or the radiation, usually, as we said, the theory is to use the androgen deprivation with or without additional radiation. And obviously, you said you've had men who work and who's worked for them, but it doesn't work for everybody. So will most men respond to this and have their cancer stabilized and go into remission, or will they ultimately fail and then have to go to something else? No, how many men out of that group that fails, which you think is about, say, 30% who fail primary radiation or primary surgery, go on to ADT, and then have that fail? What is your experience shown?
I think about 30% of the patients with high-risk prostate cancer that receive radiation plus androgen deprivation eventually might fail. But sometimes the fail might be only a PSA increase that without metastasis, that probably the patient will feel good without any symptoms, that the right. and the PSA is not a risk for the patient's life at the moment. Right. So even there is a relapse, this relapse might not be clinically relevant for the patient at the time. And also, sometimes, depending on the patients, this relapse might don't have an impact in its long-term life.
No, it's true in terms of how the drugs kick in on an individual patient, and even though they might have failed the primary therapy, they can still live. You know, I've seen guys who live 20 years with just, you know, going on hormonal therapy. So the key thing is just to really stay on top of it, become aware of it, be able to talk about it, and be able to work with the doctor in getting the right course of treatment.
Correct. And once patients need androgen deprivation therapy, what is commonly known as hormone shots, it's not about who will fail. I mean, it will work in almost everyone at the beginning. The problem is how long until it fails. Because for some people, maybe 6 months, for others 1 year, for others 5 years. And part of the research that we as a community are doing now, and we're going to be discussing next Friday, is not only about new drugs, but it's also about understanding who is going to fail in 6 months versus who is going to fail in 5 years, because maybe the guy who's going to have the treatment failing in 6 months is the one that needs a different approach.
Right, right. Well, good. We'll be back to talk more with Begonia and Joaquin right after this. And that was Rosario with Qué Bonito. Now, we're talking here with Drs. Miato and Mateo about prostate cancer and all the things that are important to it. Now, one of the things that you've noted, and despite the concerns that we've talked about a little bit earlier, both of you engage in both clinically and from research in implementing new therapies to improve the survival potential for men with advanced stage prostate cancer. What are some of those things?
Well, what we do, a part of our research is what we call clinical trials. So basically, when we have a new drug, a new pill that we think it's going to help men with prostate cancer, but we do it also for other diseases, we offer it to patients years before it's licensed in an experimental context, a more controlled context, where basically we follow the patients very closely to see how they are doing on these drugs. And in these clinical trials, which we will discuss next week a bit, is the most powerful tool that we have to prove whether a drug, a new pill, works or not. So it's very interesting because over the last few years, we have introduced several new drugs in the prostate cancer field, many more options for our patients, either with new chemotherapies or new pills or combinations of treatments. But it's important to remember that many patients would have accessed these drugs years before because we were testing them already in some hospitals.
I think the key thing also to note, because I know many, many patients, when they hear the phrase clinical trials, they think, am I a guinea pig? Yeah. Are they going to be experimenting and doing stuff to me, you know, and the benefit? I think the thing is probably we've kind of evolved to say it's really more investigational studies. You know, it's a case where we have something, a new thing, a drug, a device, whatever, that based upon data that we've developed over time, working with patients in the lab, whatever, that we think can have benefit. And we're saying to people in that, we're not giving you something for you to try. This is what we think that could have really positive benefit for you in terms of being able to treat your cancer.
Correct. I mean, it is a terminology that sometimes scares not only patients, but people working in the field. Maybe we should just change the name eventually. But there are several kinds of clinical trials. There are very early phase clinical trials, as we call them. So basically, chemicals that came out of a laboratory and we're really just trying to understand. But even those have been tested in laboratories for years before they are given to a patient. But then there are trials, more late stage clinical trials, where a drug that we know that works for good, we are trying to test whether it works better, the same or worse than what we have already in the clinic. I think that the most important message is that participating in a clinical trial is a very personal decision where the patient should feel really comfortable with, and that normally is a result of an open conversation with his physician.
So I think it's good. I think there's the whole thing, again, having the communication, having the plan, working together. Now, from your side, Begonia, in terms of clinical training, what are some of the things you've been using that you see?
Well, I am working at an academic hospital and I have had the opportunity to offer to my patients clinical trials. I am very happy with that. I feel very comfortable for the same reason that Dr. Mateo said, that we can offer patients treatments years before they have been approved. I think it's, in general, it's a very good opportunity for the patient to participate in a clinical trial, but always has to decide with the patient and their families. I think it's important. Also, I think in order to improve the survival of the patient, there are not only the clinical trials, but also the translational research that is going on today. That is very, we are working in a kind of research that we are trying to identify which patients respond to a better treatment and which and fail to another treatment, to decide, to be able to decide which is the best treatment for each patient in order to develop a personalized medicine, a treatment for prostate cancer. But this is not available yet. There are some kinds that are promising, and we're working on that. And it's probably maybe this more tailored specific treatment for the different patients might be some way to progress.
Well, I think one of the things, we've talked about the good news that's on the horizon, but people still ask, what causes prostate cancer? We know that there are several causes. It could be family history, hereditary, lifestyle, environment, genetic mutation. Help us understand some of those characterizations. Is there anything that we can do to really prevent cancer from developing?
I mean, it's never one thing. It's a complex addition of several variables. I sometimes tell my patient, well, this is like the lottery. Of course, if you have bought more ballots than others, you will have higher chances. Right. But at the end, it's impossible to predict exactly. We know that there is an important hereditary component in prostate cancer. Is among the different cancers one of the ones where the family history counts and makes a big difference. That means that, that doesn't mean that if your father has had prostate cancer, you're going to have it, but probably means that if you have had several people in your family with prostate cancer, you should be more cautious and go to a physician earlier and be checked more regularly than others. But it's not only hereditary. It's a combination of hereditary with several things, right, Begoña?
Well, I think that the hereditary component probably is the best known, but there are also some studies that suggest that maybe lifestyle are important also in the risk of development of prostate cancer, like like high fat or high sugar consumption might be something that is not good and might increase the risk or might increase the clinical evolution of the tumor when you have it. And the exercise is good, but there is something that is epidemiological, and it is difficult absolutely to say if you do exercise, you are not going to have prostate cancer.
Right.
If you eat well, you are never going to have prostate cancer. But there are there's something you better do. Do exercise and eat a healthy diet, and you will be healthier in general.
Let's say that if you follow the Mediterranean diet for cardiac care. It's also a good, you know, anti-cancer diet.
Well, I was going to say, I mean, I don't know anyone in his 40s or his 50s whose objective is, oh, I don't want to have prostate cancer. Well, no, the objective is for you to keep yourself healthy and not have this in general.
Right.
So having a healthy nutrition and an active lifestyle clearly will contribute not only to prevent prostate cancer, but other diseases.
Well, I think the whole thing, I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I wanted to say that also it's important for patients who are on androgen deprivation. Because the androgen deprivation increases the risk of cardiovascular disease and metabolic syndrome, alteration increase of your cholesterol levels might increase. And having a good lifestyle might help you to prevent the development of this, not only these diseases,
right,
and be more healthy, to be healthier, to receive also new treatments for the prostate cancer you need. There is not only the treatment of the prostate cancer. We need to be healthy to be able to receive treatments and have a better quality of life.
Totally agree. I think now we have numbers from studies that put it down in paper that keeping an active lifestyle is positive for patients that have already been diagnosed and already being treated of prostate cancer. And this is very important. I mean, it's not about, I don't expect my patients to go and run a marathon or hike the Himalaya, but keeping yourself active, walking, running if you can, or playing tennis with friends, it's important to keep certain level of physical activity for patients.
Well, I think that's good, because we start talking about the side effects of treatment. Sometimes the, you know, as you said, the cure is, you know, worse than the cause, you know, from that standpoint. So again, avoiding the risks that you face from androgen deprivation, the things you face from chemotherapy and all the rest, you know, it's key to have your health in general, you know, working for you. Now, when we look at that thing, we talk about you need to be active, you need to have a good diet. Well, we've heard that, you know, red wine is important in terms of being able to don't laugh at me. It's important in terms of being able to have a healthy lifestyle and being able to deal with some of the free radicals and all the rest of it. That is important to stop smoking, because that's an issue. What are some of the things that you encourage? I mean, do you tell people that you should have a glass of red wine a night, that you should at least walk, you know, 1 kilometer, 2 kilometers a day?
What I recommend to my patients?
Mm-hmm.
Well, we were working in a plan, recommendations plans. We give them a lot of recommendation about exercise and work every day, to go to the gym or walk every day about 20, 30 minutes, and also advices about diet and recipes, and also mind activities that we recommend them to do,
keep your mind active,
and mindfulness, the kind of things. That is something that we are encouraging to the patients to do. to prevent the progression of.
So why'd you laugh at me about red wine?
Well, because there is always a controversy, you know, about the wine. It is good. It is not. No? I think a cup of red wine
couldn't hurt. It couldn't hurt. Just good.
No, I think it's important to remind patients that they don't have to be too radical about these recommendations.
Yes.
And it's all about a balance, right?
Yes.
But I think that the smoking, it's something very important. Smoking causes lots of diseases, not only cancer. It's very important for preventing cancer to stop smoking, but also for patients who have already been diagnosed. Smoking will worsen their lung capacity and their capacity to receive certain treatments. Therefore, it is true in a more general terms that having lived abroad for a few years, when I came back to Spain, I was surprised of the number of people I see smoking in the street. It's something we have to tackle at some point. And the evidence is just so strong that this is killing people, that we cannot pay enough attention and stress it enough.
Yes, I cannot understand why people smoke.
I know.
That's important.
I know. And the thing that bothers me is I see so many young people now.
Yeah, absolutely.
Particularly young women.
Yeah, it's terrible.
Speaking, and and they say, well, it helps me keep my weight down. I say, well, okay, but, that isn't a good reason to smoke.
Yes, but we are teaching in the schools that you shouldn't smoke, and they start smoking, so the families know that. That's something.
Yes,
we have to work on.
Huh. Well, you're listening to 106.9 FM, Radio Canal Barcelona, English Radio Thursday. We'll be back to talk more with our guest right after this.
I love you. Just listen and know I love you through sun and through snow. No matter where the road will lead us, near or far, I won't ever let you. I need you. Just listen and hear how I need you forever be near. Through my whole life I've lived without it. Now I can't exist without. Your love's part of me from head to toe. So please don't ever let me go. Without it, your love's part of me.
And that was Senaig with Love Song. Now, we're talking about treatments, talking about new developments and all that. One of the things that's come to more active awareness is the therapy of active surveillance as a treatment modality. Now, what is active surveillance and what type of patient is best indicated for it?
Active surveillance means don't do any active treatment for the patient. Instead of that, the patient has to follow a very, very close follow-up with PSA and MRAs and sometimes ray biopsy. It is very important to select which patients can be candidates for active surveillance. They have to be patients with very, very low risk of progression of the disease at the beginning. The objective...
Let's stop. How do you define that risk?
The risk might be that the number of the PSA level, the different... If the histology, if the tumor is more... the aggressivity of the tumor cells than you can see in the biopsy, the image of the MRA, the number of when we diagnose a prostate cancer, we make at least eight biopsies. So we consider if the number of biopsies that are affected, no, fewer biopsies than maybe a lot of biopsies, no, indicates that the tumor has spread in the whole prostate, that maybe it's not going to be a good candidate for active surveillance.
Number of cores,
yeah. Okay. And it's not a treatment. In general, it represents a delay of the treatment, an active treatment for a patient that may need it in the 2 or 3 years later, or maybe not, depending of the age of the patient, mm-hmm. of the evolution of the disease. Sometimes.
Well, I think the whole thing is we started looking at, you know, a lot of cases where men have gotten biopsies, mm-hmm. and maybe only cancer is found in 2 cores, mm-hmm. and the volume is less than 10%. Mm-hmm. So we tell them, I said, you know, guys, you don't really need to do anything right now. Hmm. This is like you would be a great candidate for active surveillance, just to continue to watch it and just see what happens. If it grows, the PSA increases, and the re-biopsy shows that you need more, then you can do something. But right now, do not expose yourself to an active treatment. You continue to watch it. So in the course of the active surveillance, how often then does a man come back to you to get an additional PSA test, and when do you start saying, okay, it's time to get more aggressive?
This is something that the urologists mm-hmm. do. But the feeling I have with my urologists, we discuss that very often, that most of the patients who are really candidates accept active surveillance because it offers them the possibility to maintain their sexual life, you know, mm-hmm. For a period of time. And that's something that they consider good, and to avoid the aggressivity of the treatment.
Most guys would like that, yes.
Yeah. But some patients get very anxious, and maybe they accept at the beginning the active surveillance, but after a while they decided to ask for active treatment.
So the only thing that really is going to then trigger active treatment, surgery or radiation, is an increase in the disease itself,
yes.
or the anxiety of the patient.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Well, now, we've talked about the improvements in patient care, but we know that depending upon the molecular categories you look at, they're probably anywhere from 41 to 313 variants of prostate cancer. I mean, how do we know what to look for? How do we better diagnose and ultimately prevent prostate cancer when there's so many different things to look at?
Well, I mean, we already have, even before we started doing molecular studies, genetic studies, we already have categories of prostate cancer will help us understand which cancers are more likely to be more aggressive, as we were talking now about the active surveillance programs, okay? Genetics and molecular studies add an additional layer of complexity to this classification system. They are not perfect. We are still learning, but they give us additional information about the aggressiveness of tumors, but also about the difference between the tumor of one patient and another, which are not necessarily the same. They may have a different makeup in terms of the molecular composition, which on the one side may help us understand if it's going to be more or less aggressive. For me, this is very important in the early stages, because it may guide who gets active surveillance versus who gets surgery, or who gets surgery plus something additional. Maybe it's not that important when the disease has already spread, because probably it's not that relevant whether you have a bad or a very bad disease. You bother that it's a bad one, okay? But right. In that stage, we're starting to realize that some of these molecular subtypes help us choose one or another treatment for that patient specifically. We are still at the early days of this process. We're just seeing the hint of what we can do with this information. We are starting to develop treatments specifically for patients that have one particular molecular alteration, but the future is about having many treatments and being able to use them wisely, depending on not only the molecular alterations, a number of different variables, but adding the molecular composition into there.
Mm-hmm.
And then we may not have 313 subgroups. We may have as many subgroups as patients we're going right. to be seeing, because in every patient will have one particular prostate cancer that has to be managed individually.
Now, we've seen some of the new tests out, the Genome DX, or the OncoDX, and the Prolaris and others like that. Are these something that you would use as part of your regular practice?
These tests are intended to assess the risk of a patient with localized prostate cancer in terms of relapse. So how likely you are to get the disease back. And depending on that, we can decide if you need a more aggressive approach at the time of surgery. Okay? They are not perfect. They may give some information. I think we are going to have better tests in the future. Okay? But it is true that it's a piece of information that can be helpful in some cases. In the fields like in breast cancer, for example, this has been validated much more and it's being routinely implemented into clinical practice. As usual, men, we're just following women. We're just following their path. So in prostate cancer, we are following the path opening open diseases. But we're getting there. I think we're going to do much better in the next few years.
Well, one of the things that's emerging in the area of research and treatment is immunotherapy. There's question in terms of, is it valuable for prostate cancer or an advanced stage disease or not. What is immunotherapy? How does it work? And what does the future look like for it?
Well, the immunotherapy works, is a different therapy that they usually use. Activates the immune system, and is the immune system of the patient who is able to attack the tumor cells and kill tumor cells. This is a different strategy. It's not a drug that is killing the tumor cells, but it is the immune cells of the patient that are killing the tumor cells. That's a different approach for cancer treatment. And there are many different immunotherapies. There are vaccines, there are checkpoint inhibitors, there are many kind of immunotherapies that are under development now in prostate cancer. There is one active that has demonstrated a survival benefit that is available in the States, but not here in Europe. Yeah? A vaccine that improves overall survival, and there are many others under development. So I think that at this moment, the immunotherapy is experimental. There are many clinical trials in immunotherapy. And we are trying to see which patients might benefit from immunotherapy. We see that not all prostate cancer patients benefit from immunotherapy, but maybe some. Some molecular characteristics might benefit. And also it's possible that the immunotherapy alone is not enough, but the combination with other drugs might increase its effectiveness. But we are looking for the results of clinical trials.
Yeah, it's a very exciting field, actually. And it's actually a field where patients ask me a lot. They want a lot of information about what's going on with immunotherapy. Yeah. So just FYI for the listeners, next Friday at this session at Hotel 1882 in Barcelona, Friday morning, we're going to have one of our rising stars at Vallebron, Alena Gross, who is specializing in research in immunotherapy, coming to explain to patients and everyone who wants to come what is immunotherapy and what are we doing so it is transforming cancer care.
Fantastic. We'll have some closing comments right after this. And that was Eric Darius with Breaking Through. We're going to talk about some breaking through issues next Friday at our symposium.
Yeah, next Friday, Hotel 1882 in the morning, come around 9. We'll have some breakfast, we'll be chatting, and then we'll have a series of talks. I always say when we start this series of talks, if actually we don't make it to the end of the program because you're asking too many questions, that's perfect. That's perfectly what we want, is to have a very informal and welcoming atmosphere for everyone who wants to come and chat and learn a bit more about what's going on in cancer research. You are welcome. We'll be there from 9 o'clock in the morning. That's in Corsica Street near Sagrada Familia, Hotel 1882. The only thing is that probably I would recommend people who are interested to book a spot. I mean, it's completely free, but the space is limited. So if you can give us a call at 629-827452. So that's 629-827452. And Laura will kindly get your name.
She'll be happy to take your reservation absolutely. And everything and give you all the information you need to know. So tell us a little bit more also about some of the investigative studies that you guys are doing. What are some of the things that are important for you right now?
So my group mainly focuses in trying to understand the different subtypes of prostate cancer and the clinical relevance of these subtypes. So we try to get samples from patients that come to my clinic, either tumor samples or blood samples, to try to see the differences between one tumor and another. at different levels, integrating genomics, but also a study of different proteins and other parameters, and then integrate it and associate it with actually whether the patient did better or worse on different treatments to try to refine our medical decision-making into what patient should receive what treatment.
Well, good. So I think that's, again, part of the reason why folks would come out next Friday, because they can learn a little bit more about it. They can learn what they can do to be a part of the process, either participating in a study or passing information around, helping to recruit for it, helping to fund some of the efforts that you're trying to do. It's a good thing, and we're glad that both of you are here today, and they're going to see you again next Friday.
Yes.
I'll be seeing you more than that this week, but it will be really good. We're going to leave you today with a song by Kenny Polson, reminding us of a condition that we love is love. Have a great one, Barcelona. We'll see you next week.
Send me the valentine.